everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. We have an extra special guest on the show today. His name is Jeremy Turner. He is an amazing musician, Juilliard trained, master cellist, if there is such a term. He's done music for big films, small films, large scale, small scale, short films, art installations, Broadway plays. I'm not really sure if there's anything he hasn't done, but we are thrilled to have him on the show. To my left, to my right, he's always at my side, co-host Brian Kluger of Boomstick Comics and Screen Rant. Brian, how are you today?
Pleasantly neato on this wonderful Thursday.
I like your backdrop there.
Thank you. Do you recognize where it is?
Looks like it could be Fox, maybe? Hard to see. I don't recognize it. No. Where is it?
Abbey Road.
Abbey Road. Got it. Okay. Oh, yeah. That makes sense now that I see some of the stuff in the back there. Very cool.
For you.
I like it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, thank you for joining us today. Both Brian and I are thrilled. We're big Marvel fans. We're big music fans. Want to congratulate you on 10 years of solid working credits. If you could go back and give the young Jeremy some tips of advice or some lessons learned, is there anything that you want to tell young Jeremy?
Funny about that. I had kind of a fun little moment about a year and a half ago where I had that kind of, you know, a special moment in time where I thought there's no way that young Jeremy would have believed this was happening. I think the one thing I would probably tell young Jeremy is just keep doing it and don't stop, you know, don't listen to the naysayers. Don't, you know, even when I was a performer, even before I was composing, I started auditioning for orchestras at a pretty young age. And even my teacher was saying, you're not ready yet, don't do it. And then I won this position. So it's, you see it happen in sports sometimes, you know, you'll see some tennis player that rises through the ranks and makes it to the semifinals of some big tournament and they're unranked. And you just got to ride the wave, you know, and stay positive and keep doing what you love. So, that's probably what I would tell my younger self. Don't give up and just keep going.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, can you give us a little bit of backstory about your time at Juilliard and making the transition to do some playing at the Met and your time in New Zealand? Just sort of, you know, travelogue, if you will.
Yeah, sure. In a weird way, my entire career as a classical musician was a bit of a detour, and it was a long one at that. But when I was 2 or 3 years old, I was, you know, writing songs on the piano, and I started taking lessons when I was 5. When I was about 8, I wanted to, I was listening to a lot of Zeppelin, and I really wanted to play electric guitar. And my mom said, no, she did not want an electric guitar in the house. And pointed out that there was an early morning strings program in the town that I grew up in, Michigan. And she said, why don't you go do that? You know, go play violin or something like that for a year. And if you don't like it, then, you know, maybe we'll get you an acoustic guitar. But I started out on violin, but it was early, it was dark, it was before school. And I quickly realized that the cellos all got to sit down. So I switched to cello because I was a lazy little kid. And the cello has like a little, you know, scroll here that you can kind of, you know, take a nap on. And as you're learning how to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, or whatever it is. And, that was kind of, so I came to the cello sort of out of laziness. And then one by one, all the other activities, sports, musical theater, whatever else I was doing kind of dropped off. And it became pretty clear by the time I was about 16, I'd say that cello was going to be, you know, the main thing. And so I didn't apply to any universities. I only applied to conservatories and ended up at Juilliard. Juilliard was it's arguably the best music school around. It definitely is very cutthroat. all those stories you hear are true. It's maybe not the most, wasn't the most joyous place for me, but I had a really great teacher, and that was kind of the main driving force behind my staying there. And then when it comes to orchestra auditions, they're pretty few and far between. They often say that, you know, an opening only really comes up when someone dies or retires. So it's a pretty solid job once you get it. And it just happened that there was an opening at the Met when I was in the summer between my junior and senior year. And so it seemed silly not to take the audition because it was right across the street. And I didn't know a lot of opera at the time. I knew, a few of the classics or whatever. But yeah, so was very lucky, practiced hard and managed to win the position. And so that, we often refer to the orchestra jobs as the velvet handcuffs. You feel so lucky to, get paid to play music and masterpieces at that. But once the season starts, you're in New York from September through May or June or whatever it is. And sometimes, we even had to play on Christmas Day and stuff. So it's a very off-peak schedule in a way, working at night, and so you miss a lot of things. Grandmother's 90th birthday, I was like the only person that couldn't be there, kind of thing, so anyway, long story longer, it was a great time. I loved playing in the orchestra. It was really fun, but I think because I got in at such a young age and didn't have sort of the typical responsibilities that many people have when they're older, be it kids or a mortgage or whatever, I had some time and luckily some funds to explore other opportunities and other paths. And so there was a percussionist in the orchestra. We started a band and started playing shows downtown after late at night, after operas got out. I knew that there was more, there was an internal itch that I had that there was more out there for me, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. And when I went to New Zealand, that was just kind of a big pause button for me. It was by no means a career move or as my accountant told me, a financial move. But it was a really great opportunity to just get out of New York City, go live in what I still consider to be probably the most beautiful place I've ever been, and just catch my breath. I was 30 at the time. So it was kind of a big crossroads for me, and figured some stuff out when I was there. And when I came back, started a studio with a friend downtown and really started, it was all ghost and mirrors, smoke and mirrors, I guess it is. I didn't have any credits. I didn't have nothing to point to as a composer, but I knew I could do it. And I just started, clawing my way into being a composer full time. And at first it seemed kind of daunting, from the world that I came from, the word composer meant Mozart. And, I was picturing powdered wigs and tights and, writing music for the king or whatever. I wouldn't call myself a composer in the beginning. I would just say, yeah, I write music on the side or something like that. It just seemed like such a big thing. And, eventually got a couple commercials and then a short film, and one thing led to another. And, I was very late to the party because I'd had a whole career before that. I played in the orchestra for 14 years, but once I finally started writing music, and got some really great projects to work on, that's when I really felt at home. I was like, oh, this is what I'm meant to be doing. So, that's a very long answer to your question, but it was kind of funny that it took me that long to kind of eventually get back to this little kid plunking out, tunes on the piano when I was 2 or 3 years old. So
perfect. Well, you know, it's an amazing story because, you know, you spent so much time in New York City, and that's really where all the magic happens, I imagine. You know, yeah. Like you said, Juilliard's cutthroat. I even like the way you say you ended up at Juilliard. That was a nice way to phrase that. But, you know, doing work for, you know, the Mike Nichols play and art exhibits, did some of those very pointed pieces help get you to things like Five Came Back and, you know, how did that bridge the gap?
You know, it's funny, when I talk to young musicians and young composers, especially composers, you know, how do I do this? And there's so many different ways to go. So obviously you can go to school for it. You can be an assistant for a more well-established composer and kind of work your way up the ranks. Or you can do what I did and just, you know, get to the party really late and just bushwhack your way through it. But ultimately, like, you have to have the talent, like anything, you have to have the talent walking the door. Like, that's just a given.
Yeah.
You have to know what you're doing, but then a lot of it is just relationship based, you know, who you know and how, you know, you could be the most talented composer in the world, but you know, if you're living in a cabin in the middle of nowhere in Alaska, like, nobody's going to know about it. So yeah, obviously being in New York, there were some advantages to, you know, being connected to just, you know, so many incredible musicians and directors and producers. But I would say, you know, at least with regard to film, it's a much smaller community in New York than it is in LA, you know. You know, for the play, for instance, that was a very roundabout way of ending up there. James Murphy had been chosen to write some interstitial music for the play, and we'd worked together on a couple, we'd met years before. Like, he kind of, whenever he needed strings, he would call me and I'd help him out with some records or whatever, and we became friends, and he got the call to do this play. But I think, you know, James is an incredibly talented musician, but has a very, very different skill set than I do. And I think he realized he was, I don't want to say he was in deep water, but he was in definitely uncharted territories. And so he gave me a call and came over and said, you know, I'm writing music for this play and I've got these ideas, but I'm not quite sure how to execute it. And I ended up going up to a reading at Lincoln Center, which was funny because this was after I'd already left that whole part of New York and left my classical world behind, but ended up back at Lincoln Center and watched a read through of the play, and which was incredible. It was Daniel Craig, Rachel Weisz, and Rafe Spall. So it's just 3-person play, amazing. And then next thing I know, the actors leave and we sit at a table and I'm there with Mike Nichols, like, one of the greatest directors of all time.
Yeah.
And Scott Rudin and Eli Bush, who my dumbass didn't even know who they were at the time. You know, and I remember talking to another film composer friend of mine shortly afterwards. And I was like, yeah, I just had this crazy experience. I was like, this guy, Scott Rudin, he's like, dude, you had a meeting with Scott Rudin? He's like the king. You know, like, it was pretty funny. And I, of course, looked like a schmuck because I had just come, unfortunately, I'd just come from a funeral. So I was wearing a suit. You know, everyone else is in pretty relaxed clothing. And they're like, who's this dweeb who's trying to impress? But anyway, that ended up being a really incredible project to be a part of. I played cello and James played piano, and we just spent a lot of late nights making music down at his studio, and then getting into the rehearsals and getting to watch Mike Nichols in action in a theater, you know, and his attention to detail, you know, like lighting, or that's the wrong purse, or, you know, the movement and the whole, it was incredible. I learned so much from being a part of that. So anyway, yeah, there are a lot of great things happening in New York, and it was like you said, art exhibitions, and I got to play with a lot of bands and Saturday Night Live and all that kind of stuff. And to me, again, it goes back to your first question, just say yes, you know, like, say yes, figure it out, forge ahead. You're going to end up in some weird situations. I remember I played an MTV Unplugged once with Korn, and we were wearing I was wearing a monkey mask and like playing the cello, and it was just like bizarre. I was like, this is not what I want to do with my life. But say yes, you know, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. And, you know, if you're lucky, you end up in a theater with Mike Nichols. So,
yeah. Can't write that story.
Yeah.
So how many instruments are you fluent in?
That's a good question. I feel very comfortable on cello, very comfortable on piano, pretty comfortable on guitar. And then there's kind of a big drop off after that.
A big drop off?
Yeah. I mean, anything with strings, like I can pretty much figure it out.
Okay. So, going back to your younger days, and you said you might've been 16 when you knew, but was there a particular song or a moment where you thought to yourself, hey, this guy's good. I'm going places.
So it's funny. I don't know about you guys where you grew up, but you know, I grew up in a Big Ten town, university town. Oddly enough, there were.
Were you in Michigan or Pennsylvania?
Michigan.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. East Lansing. And I often joke that there was something in the water there. I don't know if it was because of the university and, you know, professors' kids or whatever it is, but we had like, you know, Larry Page, who's one of the founders of Google. He was like 2 years ahead of me. Nate Silver, the statistician, who's obviously very famous these days with elections and all that. And we had athletes. We had incredible, just a lot of really talented, multi-talented people across various disciplines that came out of my public high school. But all that being said, I always felt like I was with my people in the summertime when I would go to, you know, music camps and, you know, the American Pie, you know, band camp or whatever. So I didn't do anything with a flute, but anyway,
that we know of.
I definitely don't play flute. I would say when I was 16, I had gone to a music festival summer camp up in northern Michigan called Interlochen, which is a pretty reputable place for young artists, and had a really great summer. And you know, there are kids from all over the world that went there, and I was kind of holding my own with them and maybe even excelling a bit. And it was kind of an aha moment. I was like, I think I could do this, you know?
All right. So, that's good. And so you've had such a, you know, your career has spanned like just all over the place in such a great way. Like, I believe you've worked with a Beatle and a Talking Head, correctly?
Correct.
And like a sound system, an Arcade Fire and stuff like that. And you've also done music for commercials, such as maybe the first commercial for Google. Right. How do you approach these different types of situations? Like you said, SNL or MTV Unplugged with Korn. Do you approach a piece the same way as you do as you're conducting like a theme for a show or a movie? Or do you just go in with an open mind and just dive right in? How do you approach the creative mind space?
I think it's different for each thing, and it depends on the tool in my hands, you know, or not. But it's, you know, if I'm going in as a performer, unless I'm performing my own music, which I don't do very often, you know, I'm there to serve someone else, you know. So I have no problem, you know, I don't play a lot of cello or sit in with bands much anymore, but yeah, you go in kind of like, okay, I'm gonna do the best job I can. And it's no different from being in military or on a football team or where, like, this is my job. I'm gonna block this, you know, this person, and that's all you do. So, you know, when you're going as a performer, you know, it could be Paul McCartney or David Byrne or whatever. And I've played with David a couple times, even at Carnegie Hall. But it's like, okay, here's my part. I'm going to play it to the best of my ability. I'm here to make him and his music, you know, sound as good as it can. when I'm writing my own music, I pretty much approach everything the same way, as long as it's music for picture or for an installation, something that's not music just for music's sake. If I'm writing music for the stage, and not theater, but like an actual, you know, concert piece, that's when the shackles are completely off and I can just do whatever I want. But if I'm writing music for picture, it's pretty much, people ask me that sometimes, is it different when you're doing a film score or a TV series, or is it different when you're doing a documentary or a narrative or an action movie or a comedy? It really isn't. It's music is, I often say it's all one language. There's just lots of different dialects. And so I approach everything the same way, just open mind and dive in, you know?
Do you prefer a digital landscape to an analog landscape, or are you all analog or all digital, or a little mix of both?
A mix of both is fun. I mean, there are, depending on what it is, there's great power in opening up to the digital landscape, you know, seeing what you can blend in and add some more depth to the music. But naturally I'm drawn to an analog landscape, I think probably just because that's where my roots are, you know. I love that. I remember some friends of mine would come to the opera and maybe they weren't, you know, didn't have the best ears or weren't familiar with classical music, and I'd meet them after the show and we'd go have a beer or something, and they're like, they'd ask me all these questions, and the thing that would often blow some people away is that it was all unplugged, you know. There's no mics. Those opera singers are singing to 4,000 people with, I mean, there's a reason they don't sing every day. They have to rest their voice, you know. So but I remember even when I started noodling with guitars in my 20s, you know, I've got a pedal board and I've got some really cool electric guitars and you can make some crazy sounds, but it didn't feel like I deserved it. Somebody else created those pedals. Some other force is making those things happen. Whereas if you just have an acoustic guitar, whatever you put into it is what you're getting out of it. If I hit harder, it's going to be louder. And I remember this idea was never more clearly illustrated to me than, I don't know if you guys saw this documentary years back, but it might get loud.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And there was this scene where the Edge was, I don't remember which song he was playing, but he was playing like a famous riff and he unplugged everything so you could just hear what he was doing. And no disrespect to the Edge, he's an incredible guitarist, but like anybody could have played the thing he was playing. It was not that challenging. And then he turns all the pedals on, you're like, oh my God. You know? that's kind of my relationship with those things. I'm naturally drawn to acoustic and analog sounds. Yeah.
Excellent. Let's go back to the Scott Rudin connection for a second.
Sure.
If I'm correct, did Scott Rudin kind of pave the way for Five Came Back, that series? The reason I'm asking is there's something about what you've done to that score that really hits me in my core. And I got the opportunity to talk to you, so I want to know all about it. So
yeah, sure. That's one of my favorite projects to date, and will always have a very special place in my heart. So I'm glad that you enjoyed that it resonated with you. Scott being on that program was really kind of a roundabout way. I love Scott and we've worked together a couple of times, but it was not a situation where he's like, you know, get me the guy from the play. it was actually a more roundabout way. It was, I had worked with, Angus Wall, who, very talented guy. He won 2 Oscars for editing, and very close with Scott. Angus, I think the 2 Oscars he won were for The Social Network and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He's a very, very talented guy. And he started moving into producing and directing And we had worked together on a couple projects, and Jason Sturman, who I'm working now with on 616, he and Angus used to work together. Five Came Back was a, you know, incredible book by Mark Harris, and they had assembled this three-part series that was really impressive. And I think they were having problems with the music. It wasn't what I guess they had wanted. And so it's what we call in the business a rescue gig. So Jason called me from his honeymoon, no less, in Paris. And it was right before Thanksgiving. So almost exactly 4 years ago. He called me and said, hey, there's this project and we need music. Can you do the score? And he said, Thomas Newman already wrote the main titles. You don't have to worry about that. But, you know, we need a score for this project. I said, how many episodes? How much music? It's three episodes, wall-to-wall music. So I was like, oh, okay. So it was like 150 minutes of music, I think it was. And when is it due? It's coming out on Netflix in a couple months. I was like, okay. So it's one of those things, you know, opportunity of a lifetime. I mean, Spielberg and Rudin and all, you know, incredible story, the whole thing. But I was already on a film that was going to Sundance that I was not even half done with. My wife was pregnant. Holidays right around the corner. You know, it was not ideal timing for anything, but that's life, right? You get these calls and, like I said, say yes and figure it out later.
Yeah.
So I did something I've never done before in my life, which was I literally just took my entire life and just pushed it to the side. And I said, honey, I love you. And she flew home to Toronto for the holidays. Food was ordered. I, you know, got some cozy pajamas and set a very strict schedule. And my first call actually after saying yes was to my good friend, Abe, who's my music editor and score mixer on everything I've worked on since then. And we had met at the Sundance Labs a year or two prior up at Skywalker. And he was my first call because I was, you know, I knew I could write music and I knew I was pretty fast at writing music, but I also knew that this was going to be a logistical nightmare because I had about, I think just over 5 weeks from the time I got the phone call to first day of scoring in order to, you know, fit into the schedule. So he makes these, this is getting pretty granular. So let me know if this is boring you, but he makes these cue sheets that are just a work of art. They're these algorithms that, you know, as soon as the edit changes the length of the cue, it's all mathematical and it changes the whole thing and repopulates. And so he really lit the way for me. He's like, all right, today you're going to write these three scenes and it needs to be this kind of vibe. And it makes it sound silly, but it was almost paint by numbers. He made it so easy for me that I just would sleep for 8 hours and write music for 16 hours. And I just... And that was it. And I learned about espresso naps, which he told me about. It's probably not
good. It's an espresso nap.
It's probably not good for your heart, but you make yourself an espresso in the afternoon and then you go right to sleep. And you, if you're as tired as I was, you fall asleep pretty quickly, but the espresso kicks in about 8 or 9 minutes and you wake up and you feel kind of charged. You're ready to go.
A cat nap on crack. Okay.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, there was nothing healthy about that, but yeah, we got through it, and you know, I fought really, really hard with one of the producers on that program because I knew that score needed to be recorded. This was not like a hey, just give us some samples and bang it out quickly. I was like, no. This is. There's no way this is going to go down like that. So
I thought with Spielberg being involved, like he wouldn't even let a video game have MIDI music. I mean,
exactly. That was between all those names, you know, and I told this particular producer, I was like, hey, if you want to tell, you know, Steven Spielberg and Scott Rudin why their score sounds like it was made on a computer, like be my guest, but I'm not having that conversation. And so we fought really hard and Netflix was gracious and, you know, opened up the purse strings, and we got to do a couple of days at Warner Brothers in LA, And I called in every favor I had. I had a lot of friends from the LA Phil and one of my friends from the Juilliard String Quartet. And I just called everybody I knew. I said, hey, come on out to LA. We're gonna record this score. And it was my first big score. So it was really fun. And James Ennis, the violin soloist, is like, I call him the Michael Jordan of the violin. He's like arguably the greatest violinist on the planet. He was gracious enough to fly out and give us a day. And, but it was definitely one of those moments, again, going back to your first question, I was there conducting an orchestra full of familiar faces and my friends for this incredible project that I was really happy to be a part of in Warner Brothers. And Spielberg even told me, he says, I listened to this music in my car. And I was like, okay, at no point was I nervous. At no point was I scared. It was hard work, yes, but it was when we got to the recording, I was like, this is what I'm meant to be doing. So it was a really satisfying feeling, and turned out to be worth it. You know, we got the Emmy nomination and that was a very special project.
That is very cool.
Yeah, you know, that just that one track alone, wonderful. I mean, I don't think you can say that that's understated enough how impressive just that one track is. So the whole thing just, it's phenomenal work. So
thank you.
That is good. So with Marvel 616, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So with so many TV shows, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, cartoons, whatever, that has all their unique music to it. And what was your research like going into this show? Did you take cues from your favorite bits of the movies and TV shows and past? And did you create this, walk me through that. Like,
sure.
This is a pretty cool deal to be part of the Marvel music universe. That's a pretty amazing.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely another one of those say yes and figure it out later. It seems to be the overall theme here for our conversation this morning. I don't want to say I have a photographic memory, but I when it comes to scores and music, and I can pretty quickly dial it up and be like, oh, that's from this, and this is that moment, and sensory recall and all that. So I didn't do any research. I didn't watch or rewatch, I should say, any of the Marvel films or shows, or but had a really good sense of where things were at when I got the call in terms of what the Marvel fans have been used to or accustomed to hearing over the last few years. And, you know, so many great scores, Silvestri and Danny Elfman. And I thought might sound like a dig. It's not. I was surprised to hear how great Mark Mothersbaugh's score was for Ragnarok, because I didn't know he could do all that, you know, heroic anthemic orchestral stuff. I still kind of think of him as kind of more quirky and digital stuff, but he did a great job. So yeah, I had all that stuff already kind of internalized when I started writing music. And I scored one of the episodes from the series, but the main title was the first thing that I wrote. And so Jason Sturman, who I mentioned earlier from Five Came Back, called me, and he had just started this production company called Supper Club, which has done this whole series. And he said, hey, you know, do you want to write the main titles for this new Marvel show? And I was like, yeah, that sounds fun. Let's do it. And so we hopped on a call with Patrick Clare, who's the main title designer for the show, and brilliant, brilliant guy. He's based out of Sydney, Australia. And he's done main titles for Westworld and True Detective, and you know, he just does, you know, stunning work. And so we had a quick call, and I just kind of asked him, you know, what are your thoughts? Like, because he hadn't created anything yet. And he said, you know, this is what I'm thinking, and gave me some rough timings in his head. And I said, okay. And I just went to work. And what you hear on the main titles is the first thing I wrote, the only thing I wrote. I didn't write any alternate versions. I didn't do any revisions. I just kind of gave him the music. I thought we were going to kind of chicken and egg it a little bit. But I sent the music to him and he started, designing and animating and creating the titles, and it went up the chain and everybody was happy with it. So, I wish there was a more exciting story, but that was it. So.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. No, it's made my life a lot easier. That's for sure.
So there's something to be said about the impact you can give something in a small package. So the main titles of the show are about 40 seconds. Something like A Year in Space, which you wrote, was about 40 seconds. Right. Is there a thought process that goes into just, whether it's 5 beats per minute or 5 notes max, or like what's your thought process on such a small canvas?
It's interesting because it would be fun to have a little bit more time, like a Game of Thrones or a Westworld or, Succession. You've got probably more like 90 seconds to get something out. But that can also be a challenge in its own right. So I think, like you said, dynamite comes in small packages or whatever. It's you've got 30 seconds to bang it out and, get a theme in there, get the adrenaline pumping. But I think more than anything, I've written main titles before for some series and even for films that I've done. Like one of my favorite main titles I ever did was for this tennis documentary about Federer and Nadal called Strokes of Genius. And that was a little longer, like 60 seconds. But yeah, there is something to, I guess for lack of a better example, there's a reason everybody watches the 100 meter dash at the Olympics, and like you might tune in for a longer run, but it's just like, boom, get right to it,
Gotcha.
So yeah, you just kind of, it's like an elevator pitch, right? You've got just a short amount of time to be like, here it is, boom, whip it out, and that's it.
So you wrote the main titles and you did the entirety of the episode Lost and Found with Paul Scheer.
Yeah.
So, for those who haven't seen it, it's going to come out November 20th on Disney Plus, but it's your episode is about Paul Scheer wanting to do a TV show based on something. So he goes through the rabbit hole of 8,000 obscure Marvel characters to come up with Brute Force. And Brute Force is a 5-team hero squad of a bear, a dolphin, a kangaroo, an eagle, and a lion. And so he unearths this based in talking to the Deadpool writers and the Black Panther writers. Come up with this. It's quirky. It's very self-aware. Paul being involved as a director talks to the camera, breaking the fourth wall and so on and so forth. So, and he's the director, so he's done it all. What's your involvement interface with him? How does that, develop your themes? Let's go down the rabbit hole with your creative process.
Paul's episode was just hysterical. Shortly after I finished the main titles, I think there were only, I want to say there was 2 or 3 episodes that were kind of ramping up for post-production. And they asked me if I wanted to score one of the episodes, and I said, sure. And they told me about Paul's episode and about Brute Force and the whole thing. And so that sounds hilarious. Let's do that one. So his episode was really fun because it, as a composer, I literally used the kitchen sink, like everything in my arsenal, every tool, theremins, lap steel guitars, whistling, didgeridoos. Like it was pretty silly.
You and, love ripping some didge.
Yeah. There's a little bit of didgeridoo for Boomer, the kangaroo character. But going through, did you know, Brian, that there were over 8,000 characters in the Marvel Universe?
Yes. Okay. I used to own a comic book store in Dallas, Texas many years ago. Very familiar.
Right. That, I read comic books as a kid and stuff, and Marvel and DC, and used to get on my dirt bike and ride a 7-Eleven and get Garbage Pail Kids and all that kind of stuff. But that figure threw me. I was like, whoa, I had no idea there were that many. And then, when they go through some of the D-list, it's hilarious. Typeface and Street Poet Ray and all these. I was like, what? You know, like, so it was really funny. And so as a composer, it was a fun challenge to try and figure out, you know, what are the sounds for all these crazy characters. And then Paul's whole thing, like you said, breaking the fourth wall, and it's like as meta as it can be, taking a Marvel property and pitching it back to them, you know, and this whole thing. And so I envisioned, you know, in Paul's mind, he's making the greatest documentary film that's ever been made. And so that's when I got to lean back into the orchestra and this sort of superhero sound. And but it's all done with, you know, kind of a wink and a nod. But yeah, you could take the music when Paul's like, we're going to Comic-Con, you know, like you could take that cue and put it on Iron Man or something, and it would probably be fine. You know, so it was fun to, you know, use that power, but just in Paul's little mind about making this film, you know.
That's great. Yeah. And I love that you mentioned didgeridoo. I actually happen to have a didgeridoo here.
Excellent.
House.
Yeah, I was just lucky. I mean, I've collected some weird instruments over the years. And
what are the strangest instruments that you've gotten and what places?
There used to be a shop down on Bleecker Street. I don't know if it's still there in New York. Was it on Bleecker? Might've been on West 4th, but in the village there, right off 7th. And it was such a quirky store. You had to pay a single dollar to enter the store. And I don't know what that was all about, but I remember every time
customer
I went.
Customer tax.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess.
It's literally overhead. It keeps the lights on.
Yeah, I think it's like probably a combination of that. It's probably been there for decades. It was a very small shop. It probably also kept out a lot of riffraff, you know, like or people that weren't seriously going to buy anything. But my didgeridoo I actually got from my sister because she spent a year abroad when she was in the university in Australia, and that was my Christmas present. But some of the weirder instruments, I have something called the turtle tar. That's what I call it. I don't know what it actually is, but I got it from this shop. It is it's like a really twangy, out of tune, three string guitar, but it's made of a turtle. So like the back of the guitar is a turtle shell. there's what I imagine was his skin is the front side of the guitar, so that it has some kind of like a drum, it kind of vibrates a little bit. And then someone just like, you know, somehow configured a neck and a little handmade scroll. It looks like it's probably from Africa. I'm not sure. But that's probably the weirdest instrument I own.
That sounds something that would be used in a Tom Waits performance or a Frank Zappa performance.
Yeah. That would fit right in with
can, both of those. Can you like sing or hum like what that sounds like, that instrument sounds like?
I'm not home at the moment. I'm up in Vancouver, so I don't have it near me. Otherwise, I would take it out and play it for you. But it sounds, if I had to describe it, I always say talking about music is like dancing about architecture. But if I had to describe it, it kind of sounds like a rubber band meets a djembe drum or something like that. It just, it's both percussive and annoying at the same time. it's a very strange instrument, but yeah, that'd probably be the weirdest one I own.
That's great.
Yeah.
And go ahead, Mark.
I was gonna say, to go back to 616, so we sure. meet our quota for our interview yes. session. So you've got 8 episodes, each directed by a different director, and all 8 of them have a different composer. What was the thought process in breaking it down, and how did you lead the charge with writing the main titles? Did anybody take cues from what you did and splice it into what they were doing, or?
You know, I've only seen to date, I think I've only seen 2 of the 8. So I haven't even seen the rest of the series. So whether or not anybody took anything from what I wrote in the main titles and applied it to their individual episode, I actually don't know. I personally didn't myself, but yeah, I think, you know, if you look at other anthology series, it's not uncommon, you know, if you remember Amazing Stories from back in the day, which actually just got a reboot, I think. But yeah, different directors, different composers, different stories. You know, each one is almost a standalone film in its own right. The Japanese Spider-Man one, I'm very much looking forward to seeing that.
That's a really good one. Yeah,
sounds like a very interesting story. You know, I'll be curious to see if this goes another, you know, if they continue, because there's so many stories, like you could do this forever. I think one of the things that I was excited to learn about and makes perfect sense, I just never took the time to think about it. And you guys probably already know this, but that a lot of these characters were in the Marvel Universe were sort of reactions or responses to the times in which they came from, whether it's, you know, Iron Man military industrial complex, or, you know, Black Panther and race riots, or, you know, whatever it is. It was really, really cool to learn more in depth about the Marvel Universe. That being said, when I got to my episode, you know, it's just complete shenanigans and buffoonery. So it was, I think, like I said, I haven't seen all 8 episodes. I think mine is very clearly the comedy one.
Well, before we get into, I'm going to let Brian close this out with some fun questions, but
sure.
After seeing the sizzle reel in the Brute Force, do you think it would have the legs? Because I certainly would love to see maybe a web series, or even if it's not 30 minutes, I'd like to see more. I think they hit something.
I think that's a question that's going to get asked a lot after the series comes out. And I think it would be really cool. You know, I'd be down, you know, it's, and as is discussed in the episode, it's not, and in life, it's not always who gets there first. It's who does it best.
Good point.
Yeah. So it's like, it may be that when those 4 issues were written in, was it 1990 or something like that, it just wasn't the right time. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but I think it was almost written as a response to Transformers, or trying to, you know, kind of cash in on the excitement around that in a way. It just wasn't the right time. But now when you see these more and more adult friendly comics, you know, whether it's Adult Swim or, you know, Rick and Morty or Archer or whatever, I think there's definitely a place. And Ryan Reynolds, bless him, has just blown the doors open on all that with Deadpool. You know, I think it could be really, really, really fun to have a Brute Force series. I think it would be awesome.
Right. No, for sure. I think with something like James Gunn and Guardians of the Galaxy, that comic book itself was, nobody knew about it. And it was kind of like a small series, and that showcased James Gunn's unique comedy style and writing, that these smaller, lesser characters could be like the hit of the town.
Totally.
And people want weird, because we've been seeing so much of the original Avengers Hulk Thor. Right. So I like that you said that.
Yeah.
That is good. Very cool. All right. So ready for some fun questions there?
Yes. Ready for the fun questions.
All right. Let's do this. What is your most thrilling music experience, both as a performer / composer and as a fan?
Ooh, okay. Well, they're definitely going to be different memories.
Right.
I would say as a performer, ooh, that's a tough one. So I've had a lot of highlights for me as a performer, just things that I've been a part of. I Can I give you three?
Yeah, for sure.
As a performer, and this would be kind of mostly as a cellist, I think one of them would absolutely be performing Mahler's Third Symphony at when I was at Juilliard, going all the way back then. I think that was like I was probably 20 at the time, and it was just such a moving experience, and really kind of cemented that I wanted to play in an orchestra, and I was like, this is what I want to do. This is the power of an orchestra. That was pretty great. I got to play Verdi's Requiem in Suntory Hall in Tokyo with like Pavarotti, and you know, just the whole, and the Japanese audiences they can't get enough of Western culture. They love classical music. They're so supportive, but you can have the greatest performance ever, and you know, it's like almost like very polite, and they were all on their feet tearing up the programs and throwing it like it was confetti. It was like they just went ballistic. It was a very, very, very special performance. And then it's no longer the last show because they came back, but getting to see James and LCD Sound System at Madison Square Garden at the time it was their last show as a band. That was really awesome. That was pretty cool.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. So those are probably my favorites. Yeah.
I like that. All right. So going further, what is the most curious / strangest recording you own? Is it an album you own? Is it like an outtake from one of your sessions? What's the strangest, most curious recording you own?
Strangest, most curious recording I own. That's a really good question. I definitely have some really deep cut vinyl that, you know, you just wonder like, how was this ever made?
You know, what was it? Would you know what it is?
I'm
fascinated by that stuff. I have quite a few myself, and yeah, I just love
that. I mean, there's some really good, there's some fun sound effect ones. Like there's some haunted house ones that are just like bizarre, you know, Foley artists from the 60s or something kind of thing. But I almost bought it kind of as a joke, but I have an old vinyl of Schubert piano trios, and I can't remember the name of the ensemble, but it's a trio, a piano trio, piano, cello, and violin, and they're all nuns. And the picture, and they're all wearing their, you know, full nun gear, and they're, you know, playing. It's just so bizarre. It's like who made this? Who paid for it? How many copies are there? You know? But yeah, I don't know. There's definitely some weird stuff out there. My dad gave me some old records too. They're pretty out there.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that. And what are there any specific musical cues or music moments in films that have always stuck with you since you were little? Like you wake up and you think of this scene, this music moment inspires you or something like that.
E.T.
Specifically like where the flutes the last
10 minutes of E.T.
Yeah. Cause that's an opera in itself. Whole last 10 minutes.
I, that's such an easy one for me to answer. And I love film scores. I mean, I love going deep into, you know, Eric Korngold and Bernard Herrmann, and you know, there's so many incredible scores written over the years. But for me, yeah, the last 10 minutes of E.T., it still gets me every time.
What do you think that it's about that particular 10 minutes when the flutes come in and they're riding the bikes to the big swells and to the emotional goodbye? What do you think that is that still, like, even if you think about it without hearing it and then just hear it without seeing it, gives you goosebumps and like clogs the tear ducts?
Yeah, totally. It's, I mean, John Williams is just such a master of orchestration too. You know, it's particularly special for me because I can directly see the connective tissue from, you know, when he's, we all borrow. I don't mean this in a bad way. You know, great artists all borrow from other great artists. But you know, I can hear like, oh, this is the Stravinsky moment, and whether it's Empire Strikes Back, oh, that's the Holst moment or the Wagner moment or whatever. I do it too. I mean, I played in an opera orchestra for 14 years, so I'm naturally going to borrow ideas, whether it's orchestration or even, you know, the way an orchestra functions. But yeah, there's something about those last 10 minutes that's just so, like you said, you can listen to the music without even watching the movie and it still gets you. And I feel like I saw maybe it was a YouTube video or a documentary or behind the scenes thing when they were doing that. And this might be one of those like folklore things, so I don't know if it's true or not, but I had heard that when they were recording that, I think it was in London, maybe it was in LA, when they were actually recording that for the film, the timing wasn't, it just wasn't quite working. And, you know, these days it'd be a couple computer clicks and some edits or whatever. But back then, you know, you take out your pencil and change some tempos. And, but I think Spielberg told John Williams, just play it, just do it the way that you hear it and that you want it to go and that it makes the most musical sense, and I'll edit my picture to match. And you know, anytime I hear someone say, oh, I made this movie or I made this thing, like we got to slap some music on it or put some music on it or under it, or it's like, no, it has to be together, you know, they go hand in hand. And that's, I mean, there's so many incredible cinematic moments over the history of the film, but those last 10 minutes definitely are up there for me.
Awesome. No, for me too.
Yeah. And it's funny, from time to time, Brian and I speak to a lot of composers, and E.T. comes up like almost, Brian, would you agree, almost every other episode?
Yeah, no, I mean, what, there's something to be said about that. It is, there's very few movies that evoke that response and that emotion.
Yeah.
Just from the music.
Yeah. I wish I could, you know, suck my pipe and be like, well, if you listen to the 1943 recording of blah, 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 you know, I wish I had like a more interesting answer for you, but it's always E.T. I mean, that's just my, I love that. It's just my favorite.
Gotcha. Okay, well, Jeremy, let's do one more fun question. Let's play a hypothetical game. So, Steven Spielberg knows who you are. You are on Disney's radar. You are on Marvel's radar. So, let's say the door's open for you, and the next Iron Man comes up.
Sure.
Somehow. What would you like to do with it? And in a fun way, and of something that you think has never been done, could you do an entire movie with chamber music? Could you throw in some typewriters and some circus music? Like, was it, like
we actually used typewriter for typeface in 616.
I clicked on that, and then there's even like a little bit of circus music in sizzle reel. So
yes,
I understand the throwing the kitchen sink method into it. So let's roll the dice. What would you like to do? What plays to your sensibilities? So it sounds fun.
If it were Iron Man in particular, or just a broad question.
It could be Street Poet Ray. It could be Leather Boy. Like, you pick.
Street Poet Ray. That would actually be hilarious if somebody picked that up and somehow managed to turn it into a feature film. You know, I think it's, for me, I'm definitely old school. It, you know, come with my classical background and coming from an orchestra, and that's definitely my comfort zone. But, you know, people are doing all kinds of interesting things with scores these days. You know, Hans Zimmer has walls of synthesizers and, teams of writers, and you know, just there's all different ways to work. You know, Hildur, who's an incredible talent, you know, she did a lot of atmospheric stuff, I think, for Chernobyl.
She
also a cellist, but yeah, she had done a lot of, I guess, sampling of sounds from some factory or warehouse and somehow turned that into music. So, I mean, there's so many different ways to go. Nicholas Britell, who's a good friend and I think one of the most talented guys out there, you know, what he did with Moonlight, I thought was just absolutely brilliant, you know, slowing down things and messing with time that way. But for me, it's, you know, I'd love to say, yeah, for the next Iron Man score, you know, we're not going to use any percussion. It's all going to be, you know, leftover, you know, pieces of his uniform that got exploded in the previous films or something, or, you know, but all that stuff ends up being, for me, it's interesting to explore and it's a fun place to dance around, but it's also kind of a little shticky for me. You know, for me, it's just, if it works for a moment or for a certain thing, sure, that's great. But for me, I think I'm always going to go back to the orchestra and pencil and paper. And because and going back to your original question, Brian, about digital and analog, like one of the reasons ET works so well, for instance, but it's just that when you have humans playing and they're pouring their heart into it and they're playing their instruments, there's no substitute for them. There's no, you know, sure, Hans can get some incredible emotion blending in synthesizers but when he get that organ going in Interstellar and you hear the organ ringing in a cathedral and just like that's played by a human being and it's ringing in a hall that in a cathedral rather, there's no way to replicate that emotion and feeling. And I think whatever that is transcends through the mic into the cable onto the final mix board, all that stuff. It's when you've got real humans playing your music, I think that for me is the most powerful.
Great.
So again, I wish I had a more interesting answer for you. Like I'd like to do, you know.
No, but I like that. I like the movie stuff. We thrive on that. So
yeah,
we
like those answers.
Yeah. Well, we've enjoyed hearing everything that you have just said and listening to your stories and your music. So, Jeremy, as we close out this episode, can you tell our listeners what you got lined up next and where they can find you?
Yeah, I am, as I mentioned, somewhat old school. I'm not on any social media, never even signed up for Facebook, so I'm not much help there. But I do have a website, Jeremy Turner Studio, that has a range of things to check out, past scores and things like that. Currently out, 616, coming out November 20th. On Netflix, I've got Immigration Nation and Chef's Table, which recently came out, both of which I'm very proud of. I'm working on a Hulu film that's coming out in the new year. And actually an interesting film for Google, a documentary about search and how it functions in the world that's coming out, I think, right after Thanksgiving. So
right on.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, we'll be happy to plug those and put all that information in the tail of this post. But from Brian, myself, Go See Talk, we really had a blast today. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. I enjoyed talking with you.